Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a freshly brewed mix of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we explore jazz and improvisation through a conversation with drum standard setter Tom Rainey. We consider the pressures of dance and dance culture with psychotherapist and counsellor Terry Hyde. We take a snapshot of social change through the disability arts movement, and we get a rundown on this year's Ideas of Noise Festival with its co-directors Andy Woodward and Sarah Farmer as it kicks off an innovative programme of sound and sonic adventure. You can find an archive of all our shows to date and get in touch with ideas for future features on our website, switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. We start with a swerve into the world of musical improvisation and avant-garde jazz by way of the Tom Rainey Trio. I caught up with the man behind the cymbals to talk about the style, approach and freedoms of this intriguing soundscape. So I'm really pleased to be with Tom Rainey of the Tom Rainey Trio. Tom, thanks so much for your time.
It's my pleasure.
And it's really exciting because tonight's gig is a sort of a launch, really, of a festival in Birmingham. It's part of the Ideas of Noise Festival.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about you before we talk about the festival a little. Let's talk about what you do, because some folks will have heard your name and they will associate you with jazz and improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
And they will say you're a drummer. Mm-hmm. But you're a bit more than that, I think, aren't you? You sort of...
Well, I don't know. primarily, I'm a drummer, but I mean... That isn't necessarily a limited thing, you know. Depending on, I mean, it's just the vehicle that I use to express myself creatively, and but it's all about, you know, in the way in the music that we play, it's really all about the collaboration and finding chemistries with different people and hopefully always the different parts, the drums, and in the case of this band, guitar and saxophone. I mean, the sum's greater than the parts. Yeah, I don't really, if I were to be asked what I do, I would basically say I'm a drummer. And then if somebody asks what kind of music do you play, then I would say jazz, and they would say what kind of jazz, and then we talk about it more specifically. But primarily I'm a drummer.
And you kind of, I guess, you take up different roles depending on the kind of creative setup, if you see what I mean. So sometimes you're leading, sometimes you're sort of, not in the background, but you're kind of, and not just percussion, but you're sort of, you know, part of, as you said, a kind of wider platform.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're sort of leading or co-leading.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the case of what we're doing tonight here at the Mac, I call myself the leader, but we improvise with each other, and I basically lead by, you know, how loud I want to play, how soft I want to play, when I want to stop, when I want to start. But other than that, the members of this group they're free, you know. But I trust them, you know, and so I don't have any problem, you know, giving them all the freedom they want, because I know they're gonna make the best of it.
So let's talk a little bit about that process, because I'm intrigued by that. So improvisation, by definition, isn't structured and it isn't sort of written, as it were.
It's not written.
But there are, I guess, there are sort of, there's an outline, there's a sketch, isn't there? Is there?
Well, in our case, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of doing it. I mean, Dixieland music was improvised music, but it was the music from a certain era, and they improvised in the way they improvised with each other. And, you know, and that's 100 years ago now. And so now, you know, we do the same thing, but it's hopefully sounds relevant to what's happening today in music. In the case of this band, we don't have any preconceived structure. Whatever structure that appears is spontaneous. And there is, I mean, oftentimes we will be asked, oh, who wrote the tunes, or can you tell me what the name of the songs are and stuff like that? And they actually were quite surprised that we just kind of made that up, and we're ad-libbing. But that's how I like to do it. You know, I mean, other people, they like to maybe they like to maybe have a structure outlined for, you know, places to go. But I'm more interested in the surprise happening. You know, I like to be surprised by any art. You know, that if I go see a movie, I don't really want to know what the movie's about. And it's the same for music. I don't really want to know what's coming. You know, I just want to be constantly surprised. But not everybody's like that. So, you know, many people do really want to know what kind of music you're playing, and, you know, is it going to be this or is it going to be that? And that's all fine, but we don't do it that way.
I've heard it described as a kind of tension, if you like, between sort of riding it out and ruling it out or not ruling it out. You know, it's a kind of, mm-hmm. are there things that you perhaps wouldn't work into improvisation, or is it, you know, are there literally no rules?
There's literally no rules, but I mean, it's all just governed by our own personal tastes, you know, and that goes back to the chemistry, finding the people that your own personal tastes can exist spontaneously with, you know, and create something that seems to have some sort of cohesion. That's my goal, you know, in whatever group I play in, you know, that's what I hope. And, you know, like you said before, I mean, there are times where I'll be very much in the background. Not that I do this much anymore, but I used to, if I was playing with a singer and it's really about the songs and the singer, then I'm, you know, obviously I'm not going to be such a focal point as I might be in my own groups or other groups where it's much more collaborative.
Now, every time I read the name Tom Rainey, almost the next phrase in every sentence is New York sound, okay, or New York music. And there is an idea, isn't there, of a sort of, I suppose, a style or a genre or a...
I think less and less. I mean, I think there was a time where you could really identify stuff as being from New York. But, you know, in all aspects, but certainly in music, the world's gotten much smaller because everybody, we all have access to the same information now, just like that. So whatever I'm listening to in New York, somebody in Taiwan can be listening to the exact same thing and being informed by it and influenced by it. So I'm not so sure. I mean, the only thing about New York that's still, I think, is special is it's a gigantic magnet for talent from all over the world to assemble and to work on their art, you know, not just in music, but in every discipline. So I think New York's still sort of king in that way. But having said that, you know, here in England, certainly in London, you have a very thriving improvised music scene. In Amsterdam, you have a very thriving improvised music scene. And there's many places where, you know, there's a lot of interesting things going. So New York isn't exclusive in that way. But it still is the biggest kind of melting pot of all that.
And when you're playing and performing and rehearsing, improvising, are there things that make you think of home when you're playing? I think you're from Brooklyn, or you...
I live in Brooklyn, yeah.
So are there things that, you know, that sort of... You kind of, is there a Brooklyn strand to things? Does it?
Well, Brooklyn again. These days, there's so much. I mean, so many of my friends and so many of the people that we work with, we just all live in Brooklyn. And whereas maybe 30 years ago, maybe it was more centered in Manhattan. You know, but I don't know if there's really so much a geographical point to this. I mean, I think it's, you know, it can happen anywhere at any time. And all of us in my group, we all collaborate with people from all over the world. You know, so I mean, I'm oftentimes in Europe playing with Europeans, as well as coming over with, you know, various bands from New York to play in Europe. So it's getting a much more mixed up, and you know, it's not so geographically specific, I don't think.
So let's talk about some of the bands and ensembles, if I can use that mm-hmm. that word. At the moment, the Tom Rainey Trio, I think you've been together for about 10 years now, is that right?
Yeah, maybe even more, maybe 12 or so, yeah, but something like that. Yeah.
And you've done a few albums and EPs, yeah. And I think you've got a new one out which has got a very complicated title, which is Combobulated. Combobulated. Yeah. I knew I'd get it wrong. Combobulated. So tell us a bit about that. How's that? What's the sort of ethos of that record?
Well, it's not unlike our other records, where again the music's completely improvised. This one, the difference in this record from the other ones in the past. I mean, I think we've made two studio records and one live record before this latest Combobulated record. And the difference really in this one from the other ones is it was taken from a concert. It was a live recording, but the concert took place in a recording studio. So they were well equipped to record it well. While we were recording it, we weren't intending it necessarily to be a record. But when I heard the tapes, I thought, well, I think I can turn this into a record. What sets this apart from the other recordings is there's a wonderful guitarist and kind of a studio wizard named David Torn, who I've worked with over the years off and on. And I really wanted his input on this as far as the editing, making it sound better and, you know, just things. So it was very much, there was a lot more in the post-production of this record than I've ever done before on any other record. Mostly it's just like, here's the gig, we get it sounding as good as we can and we put it out. This one, we did a lot of tinkering with it, you know, and because I wanted to set it apart from our last record, which was also a live record, but that was just much more of just a live record. There was, you know, minimal editing and minimal manipulation of the sounds and stuff like that.
It's interesting because I guess sometimes there's a real pressure, isn't there, when you're in a, you know, sort of proper studio recording and mm-hmm. They set the tape running. There's a lot of, you know, there can be.
It can get in your head, you know, it definitely can get in your head. You know, if you're, but I mean, you know, we have to do that. I mean, we all record all the time, and so you can't get too freaked out by it. You just kind of have to, you know, trust, you know, that, you know, even if you're not feeling it, you're necessarily at the top of your game, probably somebody else in the band is, so it's probably going to end up sounding okay.
So in the trio with Ingrid and Mary, so there's drums, guitar, and sax, essentially.
Right.
Some people might see that as quite a sort of limited palette, if you like, in terms of, or a limiting palette, but actually there's a lot of freedom, isn't there?
Well, it's not a limited, I mean, it could be a limited palette depending on who the guitar player and the sax player are, but in the hands of Ingrid and Mary, it's not limited. I don't feel limited by it at all. I'm still surprised by things they come up with and sounds they make, and so but they're very unique musicians in that way, as they have many sounds and they have, you know, many ideas and many approaches to, you know, improvisation and music making.
I guess it's a bit like flying a plane, isn't it? You know, the bigger it gets, the more complicated it gets, I guess.
It can, especially with improvising. I mean, you know, yeah, if you start adding more and more people, then it becomes much more unwieldy and, you know, and but this is, I mean, it's a very contained group because it's just, you know, it's the three of us, but within that containment lies a lot of possibilities.
Now, one thing I'm interested to know is the drummer always in control? No, is the drum section? Are you the master? Are you the chief? Or does it just come across?
It doesn't. No, it's really a collaboration. Even in my own band, I wouldn't say that I'm the master. I mean, like I said, it's basically. I mean, the drums have a lot of power because they're loud. They can be very loud, and so you have, you know, so you the drummers have a lot of influence on the dynamic of, you know, of any group. And in this group, you know, I'm interested in finding a balance of, you know, very soft things and very loud things and very harsh things and very pretty things. And I like that balance. And the drums definitely aren't the, I mean, the only thing I'll say about the drums is, and I've said for many years, is there, you cannot have a good band without a good drummer. You can have a really good band with maybe somebody who's not so great on other instruments, but if the drummer's weak, then that just takes the whole thing down. Because they're generally in jazz, they're playing all the time, and because it is such an overbearing instrument, it can make or break a band depending on, you know, the expertise of the drummer.
And you've been drumming, I think, since quite a young age. Were you?
That's right. Yeah, done your research.
Yeah, family introduced you to it, maybe.
My father did it probably before. Well, I know before I old enough to remember. I just grew up with a pair of drumsticks, and it was like a hobby for, you know, my entire childhood. And by the time I got to my teens, I started taking it more seriously and started studying it and started taking part in, you know, musical music programs and whatnot, and And by, I'd say by the time I was 13 or 14, I was pretty set on this is what I want to do.
And just finally, let's just talk about some of the things that you've got coming up. Obviously, mm-hmm. you've got tonight's gig and you've got a number of other dates. And you're touring in Europe? In
the US? We're in the midst of we're nearing the end of a 12 concert tour, and so that we'll be doing that into next week, I guess, and then we go our separate ways, and everybody freelances, so everybody is involved in many projects, you know, at any given time.
And we mentioned the record, which I think came out recently, toward the end last year, I think.
Well, it's probably almost a year old now, but this is the official combobulated tour, because that's just the way it goes sometimes.
And have you got other things in the pipeline? Are you planning to lock people in the studio again?
The next thing that will happen will be I have another group that is centered around playing standards, you know, standard jazz, and hopefully in not very standard fashion, but that will be my next release sometime. Maybe not even until next year. I'm not sure how it's going to schedule with the record company, but that'll be a continuation of a band I have called Obligato, and so I'll be releasing something will be coming out in the next year or so of that.
Well, excellent. I'm really looking forward to the gig tonight.
Great.
I wish you best of luck for the remainder of the tour.
I appreciate it.
It's been great to talk to you. Thanks.
You too. Thanks.
Now we recharge our understanding of the world of dance. Terry Hyde is a retired professional dancer who matches creative experience with proactive support for dancers, teachers, students, and parents. In between his busy schedule of counselling, workshops, and lectures, I caught up with Terry to capture the detail. So joining me on the line now is Terry Hyde, who does a whole host of interesting things, principally around dance. Now, dance is an area of the arts that we're really keen to explore a little more through this program. And Terry, you're joining us, I think, from sunny Brighton.
Yes, it is sunny Brighton today.
And let's start a little bit about you and your background. So I principally work in dance, but there's a lot more to it than that.
So I was a very lively child, and to save my mother buy new furniture all the time, so I get jumping on it. It's a ballet class from the age of 6. And then the local dancing school put me in for auditions or the Royal Academy of Dance, and I won 5 one-year scholarships there. And then at the age, that's from the age of 10. At the age of 15, I joined the Royal Ballet Upper School, the senior school. And then after 2.5 years, I went joined the Royal Ballet. And that was the old Royal Ballet touring section, which is now called the Birmingham Royal Ballet.
Uh-huh. So when you started, at the age of 6, was it something you kind of fell into, or was it something that you discovered you had a kind of passion for, or was it circumstantial? How did you sort of get in at that young age?
I really liked performing and enjoyed it. Obviously, a talent spotted in me and generated, and that excitement and that enjoyment carried right the way through until I retired.
And that led you, I think, when you were 18, led you to a kind of permanent contract and a sort of more sort of stable footing, was that right?
That's right, yes, that was with the Royal Ballet touring section, so I toured a lot, I played Birmingham, I don't know how many times, and then I went and joined the London Festival of Ballet, which is now called the English National Ballet, and I was doing more character work and principal roles in that as a soloist there. I then went I wanted to do more, so I went into musical theatre. What I did was a West Side Story. I think I toured to Birmingham again. So I've been to Birmingham in many guises.
So that must have been hell of an experience to do that at that age and at that sort of level. I mean, the thing, to be exposed to that, really.
It was incredible, the feeling, as you say, from that age, going around the world, as well as the UK, entertaining royalty. It's absolutely great. And as you say, from that early age, to get that experience. And, you know, dance days are that early age. They do start at 19 and 20. But, you know, they've been training since age, some of them. That's the whole training going right the way through. If you think of people that are going to school, as in the general public, university, they start quite late, having only trained for, I don't know, 5, 6 years, in actuality, whatever they're doing.
I guess it's a bit sort of similar to football, isn't it? It's that kind of thing where you sort of you have a period where, you know, it's kind of very full on, and then you sort of retire at the age of 25, nearly. You know, not quite that, but
it was incredible the feeling, as you say, from that age, going around the world as well as the UK, entertaining royalty. It's absolutely great. And as you say, from that early age, to get that experience. And, you know, dance days are that early age. They do start at 19 and 20. But, you know, they've been training since ancient, some of them. That's the whole training going right the way through. If you think of people that are going to school, as in the general public, university, they start right late, having only trained for, I don't know, 5-6 years in actuality, whatever they're doing.
So that's quite an interesting take, isn't it? So I'm guessing in your time sort of in the industry, you've seen the sort of the art develop and change, but also you've got a real sort of feel for how the industry behaves and the kind of, you know, the sort of professional culture as much as anything. And that, I think, sort of, I guess you found yourself at a point where you know, there were sort of some personal challenges where you thought, well, actually, there are other things that I can do around this, just over and above performing.
That's right. And when I'm doing my mental health self-care workshops at pre-professional schools, this is the thing that I try and get over to the students, that ballet or dance is not the only thing in life. You know, you have a life outside of it, and to live in that ballet bubble was eye-opening when I got out of it. I thought, wow, there's another world out here. Great. And that's what I'm trying to get onto. I was at Elmhurst, which is Elmhurst Ballet School, a feeder school for Birmingham Arrested, to deal with being told and corrected every day, and pairing, and all of these other things that fall into with the body image, etc., etc.
I think one of the things that's really interesting about what you do in terms of the kind of counselling and support for dancers is that a number of people we speak to on this show use sort of dance or music or some kind of creative art to help, I guess, resolve some of the problems of sort of mental health and mental stress. But for you, it's quite different, isn't it? Because you're sort of exploring it within, you know, very much within one of those avenues.
I've seen dance therapy in action. And that really is for non-dancers. And then there's the Parkinson's, which uses dance, and Alzheimer's as well. Again, that uses dance. And some of the clips on YouTube of people with Parkinson's that cannot walk properly and are shaking, if they have done dance or they're doing dance now, it controls the shaking. It's incredible. But dancers are dancing all the time. So how do we deal with it? So there's other ways that I use. I use imagery, which is visualization, and finding out what it is that's been going on in their lives right from childhood. So that's the model I work under. So it's no good just dealing with stage 5 anxiety, whatever you want to call it, because that only is in the moment of going on stage or an audition or something like that. Something has triggered it from an earlier stage in life, right back. And during my therapy sessions, that is what I do. In the workshops, I just have to give them ideas, because it's not group therapy in these workshops. So, you know, you can't get people talking about issues, etc. So I give them ideas. They want to come to me afterwards, that's up to them. Because I do therapy via Skype. We're based on the South Coast, you can't have everyone coming down. So, and I've got clients around the world as well. Because last November, I went to Geoffrey Ballet School. I was invited there for 2 days, working with their four year groups of students. And it's fascinating, the differences between the UK and the mental health issues in America.
It must be quite a big challenge when you're working with dancers and professional dancers who, you know, have an issue of whatever nature. It must be quite a challenge for them initially. My understanding of this is that the first stage is really realizing that they need some help or support, because it's such a high pressured industry or trade, really, isn't it? You know, it's very demanding.
It is very demanding, and there are pressures, but it depends how those pressures are put upon the performers and the students. You know, you can have throwaway lines such as, when you really started lazy life, you're not going to make it as a professional. That's really demoralizing. Or, as we just had recently, I heard someone say, well, dear, you have done a lot of Christmas pudding, haven't you? Because they have a fixation about their body image. They have this thing that they need to look slim. Well, I'll say slim, but then they go beyond that, looking thin, and then becoming anorexic. In fact, when I was at the Royal Ballet School, one of our students had died from anorexia, and it was really, it was covered up. You know, it wasn't mentioned at all. They're sorry that you, etc., etc., etc. And it still goes on now, not necessarily the dying, but the anorexia, because the individual puts on themselves what they've heard other people say. It has been reinforced to them, oh, you're looking good, or you're looking better. The teachers are under pressure in their own lives as well, and they don't understand about these throwaway lines that perhaps they make, thinking that, you know, that they can take it as adults. They took it when they were working, but it's not the case. It sinks in. It digs away. Everybody is individual. Everybody has had different, unique upbringing to be able to either cope with it or not cope with it.
I was going to ask you about that sort of public perception, if you like, of dance and particular types of dance. So ballet, for example, you know, there is the kind of, I suppose, the idea of perfection, which things like the Nutcracker and Swan Lake and others sort of, I guess, encapsulate. But you've also got more of a dark side and a kind of a prejudice, if you like, around. I'm thinking about things like, you know, recent films like Black Swan and Billy Elliot. You know, there's a kind of, there's a bundle of sort of negativity around those things, and I was thinking how perhaps some of your work, how does that help challenge that kind of perception of dance, let alone of the pressures that dancers encounter?
Well, the majority of dancers don't talk. They started in the last 10 to talk about their injuries, because, you know, we used to work through our injuries. Any sort of sport or athletics, it's overuse of joint, overuse of muscle, creates this occupational hazard of suffering after you've done dancing for all those years. But they don't talk about it. So when they are students, when they are professionals, they do not talk about their mental health. One of the things that I do in the workshops, and I get them to tell me why. I mean, it's an obvious thing. There's a stigma. It's personal. This is what the answers I've been getting back. When someone starts talking about them, opening up, they realise what they've been holding on to, and the inability to actually assert their feelings to those that are either bullying them or pushing them too hard, unknowingly sometimes too hard. You know, someone say, oh, I thought you could take it. Then there's the old school of artistic directors, well, if you don't like it, you can get out.
So I'm conscious that you're probably in your second or third career, maybe. Are you kind of, you strike me as someone that sort of doesn't stop. You keep picking things up. So what's the next thing that you're going to add to that portfolio?
I'm writing a book at the moment. It's a self-help book for dancers, and it's probably for performing artists in general as well, because we're all similar things. And it's based on my workshops, and there are half a dozen case studies there.
Terry, it's been excellent to talk to you, and thanks so much for your time, and good luck with your book.
Okay, thank you, James.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
And penultimately, Ideas of Noise Festival 2020 celebrates experimental sounds across the West Midlands through a whirlwind of jazz, improv, electronica, and intriguing collaboration. Hot on the tails of the launch event, I cornered the festival co-directors to quiz them on the origins, programme, and delights of this rooting cultural fixture. So I'm joined by Andy Woodhead and Sarah Farmer, who excitingly are the co-directors of the Ideas of Noise Festival. Let's start with the concept of Ideas of Noise. And Sarah, I'll pick on you first.
Okay.
So let's explain what that is.
Ideas of Noise Festival aims to create platforms for West Midlands-based artists across different art forms, all working experimentally, create platforms for them to share their work, develop new work, and do that amongst national and internationally known artists. Yeah, we want to just create more opportunities in the region and highlight the talent that's in the area.
And Andy, there's a lot of words on the flyer I have here. There are a lot of words that describe this festival. I'm going to read some of them out. Yeah. Intercultural collaboration, sonic art, free improv. Yeah. I'm lost already, so help me with that.
Well, I think part of the idea for the festival came out of, we were seeing a lot of different crowds at different gigs that we both went to, because we were interested in a lot of different kind of art forms and stuff. So we were going to all these gigs, and it seemed like the crowds were quite partitioned at them, you know. It's like, and we kind of, from a conversation over a pint and a curry, which is how a lot of our ideas happen. We were like, why is the person who comes to the kind of like doom metal gig not interested in the kind of heavy free improv gig? Why, you know, with contemporary classical doesn't really kind of overlap too much with things that like kind of
sound art,
that kind of thing. Even though to us as artists, they don't seem that far apart, you know, in terms of what they do. So it was about musicians kind of coming together and being inspired by each other's sort of process. It was about kind of the audience sort of seeing that they've got more in common than they think as well. So it's kind of, can we get all these people to come in the same room and see a variety of different stuff over the course of a weekend or a week or whatever, you know.
So if it was a Venn diagram, your festival kind of sits right in the middle, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's
just that intersection.
Yeah. You've been looking at our branding, haven't you?
I might have had a peek.
Oh, that's nice. Somewhere
and also, the programme is, excitingly, it's not just performances, musical performances. It's quite interactive, isn't it? There's a lot of workshop and, you know, sort of seminar, and exciting seminars, not the usual kind of seminar. So you want people to join in?
Yeah, we really do. Part of this festival is making experimental sound, things that by nature maybe are a bit underground just because they work in small scale things, making that more accessible to people. We're really passionate about what we do, and we think that loads of people can really enjoy it, and the best way to get into enjoying it is to actually have a go. So doing workshops, getting involved in it, and then you start to see the process and get a real experience of it, and then it starts to make a bit more sense. It doesn't just feel outsiderish.
It's kind of getting into the kind of wiring of things.
Yeah, getting into the philosophy, just having a go, getting into the spirit of trying stuff out and, you know, testing your own boundaries, whatever that is. So we just want to make lots of opportunities for people to engage with that, to do it, you know, things that are free, things that we're bringing to them. Just give it a go.
And Andy, Sarah mentioned at the start that this is very much a West Midlands festival, and it principally, I think, takes part across three places, so Birmingham,
yep,
Coventry and Stourbridge. So you've got a real mix in those places.
Yeah, this is our first kind of venture outside of Birmingham. Our first festival that we did 2 years ago was over 3 days, mainly in Birmingham around the Digbeth area, and we're trying to sort of spread our kind of influence across the West Midlands now. So we've got an event at the Tin in Coventry on the 31st of January, which kind of has a sort of audiovisual kind of focus. Andrew Spackman is curating a bunch of delights for us there. And then in Stourbridge, we're teaming up with another kind of key influencer in the area, Richard Bruce Clay, who's a fantastic Stourbridge-based author. And he's putting together a programme that sort of reflects a spoken word kind of element to things. So yeah, we're not going it alone in these areas. We've got kind of a few key people who kind of know the area and are helping us kind of get our message across there.
And it's running, I think, until the 9th of February. Mm-hmm. And it is quite a packed programme. So Andy's mentioned some of the people you've got. Sarah, who else should we look out for? I mean, obviously, all of the lineup are excellent, but who are you particularly looking forward
obviously
to?
Obviously, great. I'm really excited about Waste Paper Opera. We've talked about that. I'm really excited about our St Paul's gig, which is new music for organ electronics, organ and sax, improvising duo, but also Andy's piece Pendulums, which is a new commissioned work for church bells and ensemble, which I don't think I've heard any new music for church bells ever. So
no, when you say organ, you mean kind of Moog and Yamaha style organ, do you?
The St Paul's church organ. So we've got Lauren Redhead and Alistair Zaldua, who are a duo who specialise in contemporary works for organ and electronics. They'll be delivering a programme of new music written by women composers from around the world that they've commissioned. And we'll also have Via Manacle, yes, Tom Tallagen, Kit Downs' project in the evening. So it's just a really nice opportunity to see a very old instrument that people think of as in a quite a stuffy way, really reimagined and really show it for the piece of adventurous technology that it is. You know, it was very cutting edge when it came out, first synthesizer.
Now, there's a clever acronym as well, I think, which is Words of Ion, Ideas of Noise, I think.
We are Ion, yes.
So, tell me about the kind of spoken word aspect, because is that using voice as noise as much as it is kind of instrumentation, or...?
I guess so. We'd have to ask our curator extraordinaire, Richard Bruce Clay, on that one, who's putting together our Stourbridge event. But he's put together a stellar lineup, and I think it's sort of writers who've... I guess it's more writers who've been influenced by music, improv, noise, that kind of thing. A lot of the authors who he's picked are kind of... Some of them are sort of like... We've got some big names from the era, like Kerry Hadley-Price, and also Brendan Higgins, who a lot of Brummies will know as Big Bren. Big Bren's combo is kind of, he often gigs with improvising musicians as his kind of combo that he does his poems to. So I think he's doing a play for this particular kind of event. So I guess it's kind of, we're interested in how art forms can kind of inspire each other as well as kind of necessarily doing something kind of straight down the line. It's words as noise, it's sort of things that are maybe less directly influenced, I guess.
And are some of the folks that you've collared, I'll use that word, to get involved in the festival, are they experimenting with new things, or are they trying sort of tested things in a different way? What's their take on it? Are they... Are they coming to it sort of frightened of what they're not allowed to do? Or?
No, we've definitely given not. That, yeah. I think we're pretty good people to produce things for. We've given them pretty free rein, really. We've selected them because we think they're really interesting in what they do, and we know that they've got something that's outside of our expertise that they can bring to the table. So we've just sort of said go ahead and just keep us posted that in case we have to veto anything. We want them to show what they're up to, not sort of work for us, but to highlight what they can do. So who else have we got? We've got Misha Phones curating her... It's going to be the sort of pilot of her first new series of Queer Noise Nights, Queer Experimental Freedoms,
yes.
What we call it. So that's really exciting to have a sort of first there.
It's quite a full programme. And you're culminating, I think, in Moseley Baths, is that right? There's a sigh.
Yeah, it's the sound of the Moseley Bath story, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a story that I've touched on a nerve.
Yeah, we're not the first and might not be the last, sadly, to have to make that noise. We were going to be using the Gala Pool, which is under renovations. Thankfully, it's being saved after many years of struggling to stay open. Unfortunately, the renovations are running behind, so we can't use the pool. It would be dangerous. But we are only over the road at the Moseley Community Hub, which is the old art school. So that's actually, it's nice to be in a space that's had a new kind of facelift and is now open to the public, a different use. We didn't even know it was open like that.
Yeah, beautiful space.
Absolutely
stunning
space.
Little space. So we're going to be in there with the last gig of the festival. Waste Paper Opera Company are coming, like their homecoming gig in Birmingham.
See, that sigh should have been a cheer, I think.
We'll do the Gala Pool another time, which will be amazing. But it's still going to be great at the Community Hub. And also, the curator is Georgia Denham, a final year music student, composer, beautiful composer and performer. And she's putting together a programme of new music from young composers, young performers, recent graduates. That will be on the same day on the 9th as well.
So as directors, co-directors, how do you find these people? How do you find these kind of new creative talents that are quite, as you mentioned, sort of, I guess, under the wire, aren't they, in some ways? They're sort of, they're not visible, are they? I know a festival like this gives them some visibility, but how do you go about finding these people? It must be quite tricky.
I guess it's a kind of mixture of things that we're aware of that were on our radar already, kind of, I knew about Kit Downs, Tom Challenger, Organ Duo for a while, and when Sarah knew about Lauren Redhead for a while as well, he'd been kind of researching organists who do kind of interesting things. So we kind of, Sarah brought one piece of the puzzle and I brought the other in terms of what we knew already. But then some of our programme is selected through open calls as well, so we have a whole programme of shorts, which are kind of like little 30-minute tasters of kind of emerging artists or established artists who are trying something in a new vein, or works in progress, people presenting things that are kind of not necessarily completely finished yet. So we do kind of open calls for our shorts program, which we selected six from very exciting artists.
We don't want to get too tunnel visioned, because as you say, it can be hard to find people. So part of this festival and the open calls is to actually widen our views and widen our sort of pool of artists, and also for future, you know, fizzles and other events, you know, just get to see a wider pool of names, really.
Now, the all-important last question is, folks listening, they want to go to the festival, they want to buy tickets, they want to find out all the exciting things that are happening. Where do they go?
They can go to ideasofnoise.com.
Excellent. Well, for now, Andy and Sarah, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
And finally, Art and Social Change, the Disability Arts Movement, is a free exhibition at Mac Birmingham's Arena Gallery, which runs until Sunday, the 22nd of March, 2020. Here's artist and exhibition curator, Anna Berry.
I'm Anna. I'm the Dash Curator in Residence at Mac Birmingham for the last year. And the culmination of my residency has been to curate this show, which is Art and Social Change, the Disability Arts Movement. And it's roughly about a group of disabled artists who worked in tandem with disabled activists around the late 80s and 90s to effect change both in public attitudes to disabled people and also in legislation. And one of the general issues we're talking about a lot in the art world is you know, who gets to be in the canon, and that's very much related to who's creating the narrative. And it's not a malign thing, but you know, who's visible and who's invisible is quite dependent on who you are and who, you know, the perspective of who's seeing. So the hope with the programme is that by putting some disabled artists into those kind of gatekeeper positions, that it will have a wider effect for being able to show other disabled artists. And that's the kind of quite direct thing, but there's the more indirect thing of just kind of, can we change the sector? Can we make a place like Mac work differently so it's more accessible or more open to employing a person like me? And can we filter that through so that other places in the sector become a little bit more broad in their idea of what access is? And can we create a model that maybe even can filter into other sectors and other industries to be followed? It's been an amazing opportunity for someone like me. The opportunity was to train up a disabled artist to be a curator, and so this is something that otherwise I would never have had the opportunity to do, and it's really changed my life. It's not too much to say that. It's been really humbling how so many people have given so much time to allow me to learn, and it's been just a real privilege to train under Jessica, whose kind of expertise and knowledge and just warmth has really steered me in the right direction. You would think that things like just making shows accessible would be like the low-hanging fruit, but even that is still like a bit of a battle, ridiculously. And then there's the kind of level above that, and can we create a career environment that disabled people can work in the sector? And at the moment, absolutely not. You know, it's that kind of everyone's doing few people's jobs because it's underfunded, you know, and a lot of it is kind of attached to much broader ideas of how the current kind of capitalist society works, basically, and the kind of constant need for arts to be justifying a bottom line. And the whole attitude to that filters down into the very specific issue of being inaccessible for people. So it feels like a big mountain to try to shift. So one of the really pragmatic challenges was balancing all the different accessibility requirements. We wanted to make it absolutely as accessible as possible. And one of the things that I discovered is that some of those things are in conflict. So things like hanging height for text for wheelchair users is kind of the same height as text for Braille, and you can't hang them both in the same place. So, you know, there were just very kind of practical challenges. For me, there were really personal challenges that I hadn't expected about understanding how to accept access when it's offered, how to kind of shrug off my social conditioning about feeling ashamed of not being able to do things in the conventional way, and just sort of learning how to accept access was really challenging, and it sort of affected a lot of personal change and personal growth and confidence for me. So going to visit artists and talking about their work with other artists has been amazing. So that's I think a highlight for any curator's job, to get to do that. But also for me, just being able to come to Mac and be involved with the people, it actually makes me really happy to come here. So I'm going to be quite depressed, I think, when it ends and I don't get to come here anymore.
Anna Berry will be hosting a curator talk and tour on Thursday, the 27th of February. For more information, you can visit macbirmingham.co.uk or call the box office on 0121 446 3232. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Tom Rainey and the Tom Rainey Trio, TDE Promotions, Mac Birmingham, Terry Hyde at counsellingfordancers.com, M7PR, and Andy and Sarah from the Ideas of Noise Festival. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.